displeasing thee, as of the pains annexed to sin. Yet fearing I might be mistaken and commit a fault in not getting the indulgences, for I had never heard of anyone being in such a way before, I returned again to try to get them, but in vain. Not knowing what to do, I resigned myself to our Lord. When I returned home, I wrote to the good father that he had made what I had written a part of his sermon, reciting it verbatim as I had written it. I now quitted all company, bade farewell forever to all plays and diversions, dancing, unprofitable walks, and parties of pleasure. For 2 years, I had left off dressing my hair. It became me, and my husband approved it. My only pleasure now was to steal some moments to be alone with thee, O thou who art my only love. All other pleasure was a pain to me. I lost not thy presence, which was given me by a continual infusion, not as I had imagined, by the efforts of the head, or by force of thought in meditating on God, but in the will, where I tasted with unutterable sweetness the enjoyment of the beloved object. In a happy experience, I knew that the soul was created to enjoy its God. The union of the will subjects the soul to God, conforms it to all his pleasure, causes self-will gradually to die. Lastly, in drawing with it the other powers, by means of the charity with which it is filled, it causes them gradually to be united in the center and lost there as to their own nature and operations. This loss is called the annihilation of the powers. Although in themselves they still subsist, yet they seem annihilated to us. In proportion as charity fills and inflames, it becomes so strong as by degrees to surmount all the activities of the will of man, subjecting it to that of God. When the soul is docile and leaves itself to be purified and emptied of all that which it has of its own, opposite to the will of God, it finds itself by little and little detached from every emotion of its own and placed in a holy indifference, wishing nothing but what God does and wills. This never can be affected by the activity of our own will, even though it were employed in continual acts of resignation. These, though very virtuous, are so far one's own actions and cause the will to subsist in a multiplicity, in a kind of separate distinction or dissimilitude from God. When the will of the creature entirely submits to that of the Creator, suffering freely and voluntarily, and yielding only a concurrence to the divine will, which is its absolute submission, suffering itself to be totally surmounted and destroyed by the operations of love, this absorbs the will into self, consummates it in that of God, and purifies it from all narrowness, dissimilitude, and selfishness. The case is the same with the other two powers. By means of charity, the two other theological virtues, faith and hope, are introduced. Faith so strongly seizes on the understanding as to make it decline all reasonings, all particular illuminations and illustrations, however sublime. This sufficiently demonstrates how far visions, revelations, and ecstasies differ from this and hinder the soul from being lost in God. Although by them it appears lost in Him for some transient moments, yet it is not a true loss, since the soul which is entirely lost in God no more finds itself again. Faith then makes the soul lose every distinct light in order to place it in its own pure light. The memory, too, finds all its little activities surmounted by degrees and absorbed in hope. Finally, the powers are all concentrated and lost in pure love. It engulfs them into itself by means of their sovereign, the will. The will is the sovereign of the powers, and charity is the queen of the virtues, and unites them all in herself. This reunion thus made is called the central union or unity. By means of the will and love, all are reunited in the center of the soul in God, who is our ultimate end. According to St. John, he who dwelleth in love dwelleth in God, for God is love. This union of my will to thine, O my God, and this ineffable presence was so sweet and powerful that I was compelled to yield to its delightful power, power which was strict and severe to my minutest faults. Chapter 11. My senses, as I have described, were continually mortified and under perpetual restraint. To conquer them totally, it is necessary to deny them the smallest relaxation until the victory is completed. We see those who content themselves practicing great outward austerities, yet by indulging their senses in what is called innocent and necessary, they remain forever unsubdued. Austerities, however severe, will not conquer the senses. To destroy their power, the most effectual means is, in general, to deny them firmly what will please, and to persevere in this, until they are reduced to be without desire or repugnance. If we attempt, during the warfare, to grant them any relaxation, we act like those who, under pretext of strengthening a man who was condemned to be starved to death, should give him from time to time a little nourishment. It indeed would prolong his torments and postpone his death. It is just the same with the death of the senses, the powers, the understanding, and self-will. If we do not eradicate every remains of self-subsisting in these, we support them in a dying life to the end. This state and its termination are clearly set forth by Paul. He speaks of bearing about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, 2 Corinthians 4:10. But lest we should rest here, he fully distinguishes this from the state of being dead and having our life hid with Christ in God. It is only by a total death to self we can be lost in God. He who is thus dead has no further need of mortification. The very end of mortification is accomplished in him, and all is become new. It is an unhappy error in these good souls who have arrived at a conquest of the bodily senses through this unremitted and continual mortification that they should still continue attached to the exercise of it. They should rather drop their attention thereto and remain in indifference, accepting with equality the good as the bad, the sweet as the bitter, and bend their whole attention to a labor of greater importance, namely, the mortification of the mind and self-will. They should begin by dropping all the activity of self, which can never be done without the most profound prayer. No more than the death of the senses can be perfected without profound recollection joined to mortification. Indeed, recollection is the chief means whereby we attain to a conquest of the senses. It detaches and separates us from them, and sweetly saps the very cause from whence they derive their influence over us. The more thou didst augment my love and my patience, O my Lord, the less respite I had from the most oppressive crosses, but love rendered them easy to bear. O ye poor souls who exhaust yourself with needless vexation, if you would but seek God in your heart, there would be a speedy end to all your troubles. The increase of crosses would proportionately increase your delight. Love, at the beginning, a thirst for mortification impelled me to seek and invent various kinds. It is surprising that as soon as the bitterness of any new mode of mortification was exhausted, another kind was pointed to me, and I was inwardly led to pursue it. Divine love so enlightened my heart and so scrutinized into its secret springs that the smallest defects became exposed. If I was about to speak, something wrong was instantly pointed to me, and I was compelled to silence. If I kept silence, faults were presently discovered. In every action there was something defective. In my mortifications, my penances, my almsgiving, my retirement, I was faulty. When I walked, I observed there was something wrong. If I spoke any way in my own favor, I saw pride. If I said within myself, alas, I will speak no more, here was self. If I was cheerful and open, I was condemned. Pure love always found matter for reproof in me, and was jealous that nothing should escape unnoticed. It was not that I was particularly attentive over myself, for it was even with constraint that I could look at all at myself. My attention toward God, by an attachment of my will to His, was without intermission. I waited continually upon Him, and He watched incessantly over me, and He so led me by His providence that I forgot all things. I knew not how to communicate what I felt to anyone. I was so lost to myself that I could scarcely go about self-examination. When I attempted it, all ideas of myself immediately disappeared. I found myself occupied with my one object, without distinction of ideas. I was absorbed in peace inexpressible. I saw by the eye of faith that it was God that thus wholly possessed me, but I did not reason at all about it. It must not, however, be supposed that divine love suffered my faults to go unpunished. O Lord, with what rigor dost thou punish the most faithful, the most loving and beloved of thy children? I mean not externally, for this would be inadequate to the smallest fault in a soul that God is about to purify radically. The punishments it can inflict on itself are rather gratifications and refreshments than otherwise. Indeed, the manner in which He corrects His chosen must be felt, or it is impossible to conceive how dreadful it is. In my attempt to explain it, I shall be unintelligible, except to experienced souls. It is an internal burning, a secret fire sent from God to purge away the fault, giving extreme pain until this purification is complete. It is like a dislocated joint which is in incessant torment until the bone is replaced. This pain is so severe that the soul would do anything to satisfy God for the fault and would rather be torn in pieces than endure the torment. Sometimes the soul flies to others and opens her state that she may find consolation. Thereby she frustrates God's designs for her. It is of the utmost consequence to know what use to make of the distress. The whole of one's spiritual advancement depends on it. We should, at these seasons of internal anguish, obscurity, and mourning, cooperate with God, endure His consuming torture in its utmost extent, while it continues, without attempting to lessen or increase it. Bear it passively, nor seek to satisfy God by anything we can do of ourselves. To continue passive at such a time is extremely difficult and requires great firmness and courage. I knew some who never advanced farther in the spiritual process because they grew impatient and sought means of consolation. Chapter 12. The treatment of my husband and mother-in-law, however rigorous and insulting, I now bore silently. I made no replies, and this was not so difficult for me, because the greatness of my interior occupation and what passed within rendered me insensible to all the rest. There were times when I was left to myself. Then I could not refrain from tears. I did the lowest offices for them to humble myself. All this did not win their favor. When they were in a rage, although I could not find that I had given them any occasion, yet I did not fail to beg their pardon, even from the girl of whom I have spoken. I had a good deal of pain to surmount myself as to the last. She became the more insolent for it, reproaching me with things which ought to have made her blush and have covered her with shame. As she saw that I contradicted and resisted her no more in anything, she proceeded to treat me worse, and when I asked her pardon, she triumphed, saying, I knew very well I was in the right. Her arrogance rose to the height that I would not have treated the meanest slave. One day, as she was dressing me, she pulled me roughly and spoke to me insolently. I said, It is not my account that I am willing to answer you, for you give me no pain. but lest you should act thus before persons to whom it would give offense. Moreover, as I am your mistress, God is assuredly offended with you. She left me that moment and ran like a madwoman to meet my husband, telling him she would stay no longer. I treated her so ill that I hated her for the care she took of him in his continual indispositions, wanting her not to do any service for him. My husband was very hasty, so he took fire at these words. I finished dressing alone. Since she had left me, I dared not call another girl. She would not suffer another girl to come near me. I saw my husband coming like a lion. He was never in such a rage as this. I thought he was going to strike me. I awaited the blow with tranquility. He threatened with his uplifted crutch. I thought he was going to knock me down. Holding myself closely united to God, I beheld it without pain. He did not strike me, for he had presence of mind enough to see what indignity it would be. In his rage, he threw it at me. It fell near me, but it did not touch me. He then discharged himself in language as if I had been a street beggar or the most infamous of creatures. I kept profound silence, being recollected in the Lord. The girl in the meantime came in. At the sight of her, his rage redoubled. I kept near to God, as a victim disposed to suffer whatever he would permit. My husband ordered me to beg her pardon, which I readily did, and thereby appeased him. I went into my closet, where I no sooner was than my divine director impelled me to make this girl a present, to recompense her for the cross which she had caused me. She was a little astonished, but her heart was too hard to be gained. I often acted thus because she frequently gave me opportunities. She had a singular dexterity in attending the sick. My husband, ailing almost continually, would suffer no other person to administer to him. He had a very great regard for her. She was artful. In his presence, she affected an extraordinary respect for me. When he was not present, if I said a word to her, though with the greatest mildness, and if she heard him coming, she cried out with all her might that she was unhappy. She acted like one distressed, so that, without informing himself of the truth, he was irritated against me, as was also my mother-in-law. The violence I did to my proud and hasty nature was so great that I could hold out no longer. I was quite spent with it. It seemed sometimes as if I was inwardly rent, and I have often fallen sick with the struggle. She did not forbear exclaiming against me, even before persons of distinction who came to see me. If I was silent, she took offense at that yet more, and said that I despised her. She cried me down and made complaints to everybody. All this redounded to my honor and her own disgrace. My reputation was so well established on account of my exterior modesty, my devotion, and the great acts of charity which I did, that nothing could shake it. Sometimes she ran out into the street crying out against me. At one time she exclaimed, "Am not I very unhappy to have such a mistress?" People gathered about her to know what I had done to her, and not knowing what to say, she answered that I had not spoken to her all the day. They returned laughing and said, "She has done you no great harm, then." I am surprised at the blindness of confessors and at their permitting their penitents to conceal so much of the truth from them. The confessor of this girl made her pass for a saint. This he said in my hearing. I answered nothing, for love would not permit me to speak of my troubles. I should consecrate them all to God by a profound silence. My husband was out of humor with my devotion. "What," said he, "you love God so much that you love me no longer?" So little did he comprehend that the true conjugal love is that which the Lord himself forms in the heart that loves him. "O thou who art pure and holy, thou didst imprint in me from the first such a love of chastity that there was nothing in the world which I would not have undergone to possess and preserve it. I endeavored to be agreeable to my husband in anything, and to please him in everything he could require of me. God gave me such a purity of soul at that time that I had not so much as a bad thought. Sometimes